In the case of countries that were on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy, the year 2023 was not a stellar year for the U.S. From the maximum pressure campaign against Iran, which included sanctions and riot support, i.e. regime change, to the war on Yemen, the U.S. has not achieved any of its desired results. We will look at whether the U.S. objectives are what's at fault here, including the miserable state of Afghanistan, and how the U.S. continues to loot Syrian oil, while many of its allies are getting closer to Syria once again. Iran, Syria, Yemen, and Afghanistan, and U.S. foreign policy failures, that's what we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. Our guests are Masoud Chaudhry from the Islamic Human Rights Commission joins us from London. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Masoud Chaudhry, first over to you. Rightly so, I'll begin with the Iran riots and the way that I should say the U.S. Mainly, but it's really the U.S. and its spy agency, the CIA, along with other spy agencies, which include UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. That was a joint statement by the intel ministries of Iran that came out and accused all of them. But the CIA seemed to have been pivotal in the role that it played and how they cooperated with each other in order to execute ultimately what they have in mind, which was a regime change policy. Do you think that has failed?
Absolutely. I think not only it has failed, but it was implemented because of the other failures, because of the failure of maximum pressure, because of the failure of trying to convince even other nations to sort of become an opponent of Iran. The reality is there is this imprint being given, international community, that everyone is against Iran. But the reality is that everyone is just United States, Canada, and the Western sort of European, plus Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's not everyone. The reality is the world much bigger. This impression which has been created, it's there to serve the hegemony of United States. And I think we are seeing these sort of desperate now, vis-a-vis sort of trying to sort of destabilize Iran from internally. It's because everything else has failed. And I'll go even further and say United States of America and its hegemony is on the end of its time. We are seeing the beginning of the end of that power. And that is why actually its policies around the world are failure altogether. When you look at its policy with China, policy in South America, its policy with Russia, whichever policy that you're looking at, it actually failing because United States is failing. United States is losing its power, and it knows, and it is actually becoming more oppressive and more aggressive because of that fact.
Zafar Bangash, it's very telling the way that the U.S. has actually carried out its maximum pressure campaign. When you take a look back not too far long, ago, back in 2007, where there was a report that the U.S. was secretly funding what was called militant ethnic separatist groups in Iran. And this was in order to pile up pressure on the Islamic Republic to give up its nuclear program. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because We had Iran's leader not too long ago actually make a statement almost to that effect, where he said that the recent riots are part of the West's pressure campaign on Iran to compromise on its rights in the negotiations that were taking place in terms of Iran's civilian nuclear program. So we can see that this resembles what's happening now with what was happening back then. Bush Jr., $400 million was what he had allocated to covert activities against Iran. Even back then, it failed. So this maximum pressure campaign, which involves sanctions, by the way, which Iranians have suffered from it when it comes especially in the field of health, has failed, yet the U.S. has not learned its lesson. Why is that?
Well, basically because the U.S. is addicted to war, or should I say that the American rulers are addicted to war, because war for the American rulers is a racket. They earn a lot of money from it. If you look at the recent military budget that the Biden regime had sent to Congress, the regime asked for $813 billion, which is in fact the highest military budget in American history. And yet the Congress approved $858 billion in military budget for next year. So that means that the Congress is also in the pocket of the arms industry, the weapons manufacturers, and it is in the U.S.'s interest, or the oligarchs' interest, to continue to wage wars around the world, to continue campaigns of destabilization. And their target, the specific target, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, for the simple reason that the Islamic Republic of Iran has broken out of the stranglehold of the hegemonic world order that had been created after the Second World War. So Iran's example in terms of pursuing an independent foreign policy, both foreign policy as well as internal policy, is seen by the United States oligarchs as a threat to their hegemony. And so they continue to attempt different ways, even though, as you mentioned, all of their tactics so far over the last 44 years have failed as far as Iran is concerned, but they don't give up. They keep on trying one way or the other. It is because they are addicted to imposing their hegemony on others. But regrettably for the U.S., the world is changing rapidly. It is no longer a unipolar world. It has become a multipolar world in which Iran plays a pivotal role. And so in that sense, Iran continues to be a major target of the United States despite its successive failures. And now we see the U.S. is even taking on Russia and China. Again, I think it is going to face massive failures over there as well, because there are a number of issues that are coming to the fore, a number of policies that are being implemented that would ultimately undermine American blackmailing tactics and these aggressive tactics that would herald the end of America as an empire.
When our guest there talks about the defense budget, I should say, Matt Suchadra, shouldn't it appropriately be called a war budget? Because we're looking at how that has played out in West Asia. And the next country we'd like to focus on and ask you about is Yemen. I mean, we know the humanitarian situation there. We know the fact that Joe Biden came out during his presidential campaign saying, I'm going to make sure that this war stops. But he didn't do that. He even backtracked on that pledge. One of the sales was $650 million to Saudi Arabia. Why did he backtrack on that pledge that he so touted during his presidential campaign, along with other Democratic lawmakers?
Well, I would go even further. I would not even just call it war budget. I would say colonial budget. They are war would be described as defensive. It's actually the offensive, abusive war, which is unleashed on Yemen, one of the poorest nation, and it has created the greatest catastrophe of time. And we see the same thing everywhere else. Look at the handiwork of United States and its allies, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, South America, and everywhere they have shown their ugly head. They have brought nothing except this stability, They've not brought any democracy anywhere. As a matter of fact, the only democracy...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Master Shajar, we have a bad connection with you. Your words are getting repeated. I do apologize. Let's try to fix that. And let me turn to Zafar Bengash. Zafar Bengash, so we have this relationship between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince, which is on the rocks, should I say. But it's not something that is behind closed doors. We have seen the very cool reception that the Saudi Crown Prince gave Joe Biden, quite the opposite to what it did with Chinese President Xi Jinping. But going back to Yemen, which is suffering one of the worst, if not the worst, humanitarian situation, and given the fact that this relationship has cooled down, why doesn't the U.S. President take advantage of that and make good on his pledge and stop the support that it gives Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war in Yemen?
Well, we need to understand why the United States is actually supporting the war on Yemen. Back in 2001, immediately after 9/11, one of the American generals, General Wesley Clark, he said in an interview that he had gone to the Pentagon about a week or 10 days after the events of 9/11. And there, one of the generals told him that the United States has decided to overthrow the governments in seven countries. And among the list of those countries, of course, in addition to Iraq, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Sudan, Syria, etc., Yemen was also included in that. And the reason why the Americans are backing the Saudi war in Yemen is because the Americans want to control the flow of oil through the Red Sea, particularly, Bab al-Mandab, which is crucial to the flow of oil from there, just like the American military or naval armada prowls in the Persian Gulf. So they also want to control the flow of oil through the Red Sea. And the fact that in Yemen, the Ansarullah fighters have basically taken control of much of the northern part of Yemen, that obviously is seen as a threat to U.S. hegemony. So on the one hand, while Biden has a personal grudge against Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince as well as Saudi prime minister, as far as U.S. policy in Yemen is concerned, it continues with that aggressive tone because of its desire to control the flow of oil through that region. And we see that, the Americans, the British, the French, they're all supporting the Saudis with massive amounts of armaments. So as long as they sell their weapons to the Saudis, even if there is a personal tiff between Mohammed bin Salman and Biden, that is not allowed to come in the way. So the Yemeni policy has to be seen in that broader context rather than this narrow context of Biden's dislike of Mohammed bin Salman.
I'd like to figure out the U.S. policy, really, when it comes to countries in the West Asia region, Masoud Shajar. And I'm going to start out with a quote before I ask you the question and see if you can maybe guess as to which country this is. When you have Bob Crowley, the retired Army colonel, who served as the counterinsurgency advisor at the U.S. military headquarters in this country, who said, "The strategy became self-validating. Every data point was altered to present the best possible picture." Another, Donald Rumsfeld, I'm sure you're familiar with him, who's passed away, who was the U.S. Defense Secretary, who said, "I have no visibility into who the bad guys are." The country, Afghanistan. You would think that the U.S. would, at a minimum, know what's going on there. But this particular investigative report, which revealed some real truths, showed the not even the elementary aspects of war was known to the highest war and military personnel that were involved in it.
Yes, absolutely. I think that sort of re-strengthened the reality that some people think that the United States policies in Middle East and South America and elsewhere is for national interest. But the reality is that it's not for the national interest as we know it, the interest of all the Americans. It's actually for the interest of a small section of powerful lobbyists and influencers like the arms industry, like the Zionist lobby, and so forth and so on. And then when you look at it from that perspective, then you really understand why we are getting what we are getting. Why is it that they go to war when it's not really the interest of anyone? It's not the interest of ordinary people in the United States. It's not the interest of people in locality. They destroy and they're deliberately creating havoc. And, you know, under the name of trying to bring democracy. And this policy, it's really so embedded into U.S. If you remember just a couple of months ago, even the progressives like Sanders were coming out and saying, hell with Saudi Arabia. They're not bringing the price down. We should go for them. You know, it really, it seems that they are so aggressive against everyone. What is defined as sort of American interest is really nothing more than selling as much arm, looking after that 1%, not the whole 90, not the rest of the 99% of people in the United States. And this is the corruption in the highest level, which is part and parcel of the hegemony of United States. And indeed, it's because of this that we are seeing the beginning of the end of the empire. And because, you know, even ordinary people in the United States are awakening to this.
Sure. Well, let's move on to Syria, Zafar Bangash, and take a look at the U.S. policy on Syria. Well, there was a U.S. policy on Syria, I think, when they started getting engaged in offensives against the democratically elected president of that country, Bashar al-Assad, which many turned out to say that that became an obsession to remove him from power. But what is the U.S. policy on Syria now? I mean, I'm safe to assume or conclude that their U.S. policy failed. And this involved a number of their allies that poured a lot of money and arms into this. So what is the U.S. policy on Syria now? What is it doing in Syria?
Well, basically, the U.S. Policy on Syria is not only a total failure, but they're trying to cover up their failure by stealing Syrian oil and Syrian grain. Basically, the U.S. Got involved in Syria as part of that overall policy that was outlined back in 2001, immediately after 9/11, that they wanted to bring down the government of Syria. And the ultimate objective, of course, was that once the government of Syria is overthrown, then that would open the way for the U.S. to militarily attack Iran and overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. But of course, because of the help that Iran and Hezbollah and later on Russia extended to Syria, that the Syrian government was not overthrown. The Syrian government held its ground, and today even America's allies have realized that they cannot overthrow the government in Syria, that they have to deal with Bashar al-Assad, that he is the legitimately elected president of Syria, and that they have to deal with it. And so in that sense, America's policy is a total failure. And this is where I think it is important to keep in mind that when there is a sound policy to confront American hegemony, that it can be defeated, it can be brought to its knees. And today, obviously, in Syria, we find that the United States policy has completely failed, as it failed in Iraq, as it failed in Afghanistan. It was a total disaster in Afghanistan. The U.S., after 20 years, had to put its tail between its legs and flee the country, and leaving it devastated. And yet, through those ragtag bands of the Taliban, the Americans were defeated. So we see that at every level, American policies have failed in the West Asia and Middle Eastern region. But as I mentioned earlier on, because of the American oligarchs' obsession with wars, they unfortunately do not give up their mischief-making until they are so soundly defeated that the American economy is brought to its knees, and then they will actually get back into their own territory and stop interfering and disrupting the lives of other people.
Master Shajar, I guess Zafar Bangash says that here he made a point to highlight that he said, you see, when countries unite, they can actually realize their mistake. And then at this point, the rapprochement that's happening between Syria and some of the countries that were against President Bashar al-Assad, for example, Turkey, potentially now working on that. And then we had the UAE that embraced the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But isn't it sad that it has to come down to that when you involve more than 500,000 people that have been killed? I mean, every one of the scenarios of these countries that we talked about involves a lot of suffering, involves a humanitarian catastrophe. Not only these countries, we don't have time to talk about Iraq. And of course, we're looking, my question to you, at the future. The U.S. is still aggressively pursuing a war, on a war path when it comes to, for example, Russia and China. My question is, what can be done to prevent that from happening? Or is that just the state of affairs when you have what some have called a bully on the world stage that wants to get its way through, especially when they have an $850 billion war budget?
Absolutely. And it's not just the war budget. It's actually the propaganda machine, the Western sort of media, and the way that they're silencing everyone else, shrinking spaces for the truth to be spoken to the power. And when you put all these things together, we are getting what we are getting now. But I think it's very important, as you highlighted, that there is a remedy to stand up against aggression, to resist against it, to come together like what happened in Syria. But even on sort of the situation in Afghanistan showed that even the Taliban resisting over all that period, they were eventually victorious, and the United States had to put his tail between his leg and run away. What is very important for us to sort of highlight this internationally? Look, one could argue that it was a bad policy what happened in Afghanistan, and it was a misguided policy. They underestimated, et cetera, et cetera. Then it happens in Iraq. You know, and all of us sort of campaign against that war, saying it's going to bring nothing except misery, death, and destruction. And we were proven right. And then we saw it happening in Libya and in Syria. For God's sake, how many more we have to see this sort of policy of destruction to benefit the Zionist entity, to benefit the war industry and the manufacturing of weapons, to benefit that 1% while everybody else suffers. We need to speak out much more clearer on this. And the danger for United States is for people to wake up. And this is why they're silencing, be it RT or be it press TV or be it even social media. There is an attempt to demonize anyone who's speaking the truth to power. And I think we need to recognize that the only way forward is for us to actually speak louder and clearer and make sure that people in Europe and elsewhere understand the real policy of death and destruction.
Thank you so much for that. Master Shajar, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, and Zafar Bangash, thank you, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In today's discussion, with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Islamic lifestyle, and that is Salah, which is a 5 daily prayer that is an important part of the Muslim lifestyle. We find as part of nurturing this into our children, it is very important for us to realize that It needs to be done in a very gradual way, without excess, without pressure, and indeed through gradual introduction of role modeling on the part of the parents. When it comes to strategies to be used for introducing Salah, we need to realize that there are quite a few different strategies that can be used. But on one hand, we need to also realize that Salah is an act that is clearly defined, and it has specific conditions, etiquettes, and qualities that cannot be added or subtracted. They cannot be deviated from the form that has been provided to us by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through the Quran and in the Islamic traditions. And indeed, it's very important to introduce Salah and make the child aware of Salah in a very clear and thorough manner. One of the ways that we can do this is through verbally defining and introducing Salah for the children. One of the ways that we can do this is by mentioning the purpose and philosophy behind Salah and what is the actual need for Salah. We have this from the Islamic traditions that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam talks about the purpose and philosophy behind Salah. And he says, Salah is an acclamation of the lordship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It is a negation of polytheism and shirk. And it is the standing before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with utmost humility and submission. And it is also the realization and acclamation of one's sins before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and seeking forgiveness for them 5 times in a day by placing our foreheads on the ground before the majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And indeed, this is just a part of the tradition that we have from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. But this in itself tells us that Salah, being such an important aspect of the Islamic lifestyle, an important value amongst all the values of the Islamic system, we find explaining its philosophy and its purpose is one of the ways that the child, the youth, can be introduced to Salah and made aware of the importance of the performance of Salah. As parents, we need to understand its importance ourselves and thereafter gradually introduce this concept of the philosophy of Salah to our children so that they themselves feel more humble when it comes to the performance of Salah and more enthusiastic when they approach Salah. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Historic electoral breakdowns in the United States continue to multiply. For the first time in 100 years, Congress has failed to immediately elect a speaker for the House of Representatives, which is the nation's number three post following the vice president. After 2 days and more than a handful of votes, a group of around 20 so-called Trumpist lawmakers continue to reject the mainstream Republican, Kevin McCarthy. An irony is that Donald Trump urged Republicans to unite behind McCarthy, a reflection of the deep divisions in a politically reconfigured nation.
It's kind of the Republican establishment not knowing how to deal with the monster that both the corporate and right-wing media systems have kind of created over the last kind of period, the emergence of Trump as a political figure and then the rise of Trumpism. It's really kind of gotten away from at least the establishment Republicans that would very much like to be able to wash their hands of January 6th and can't.
The failure to choose a speaker reduces Congress to total standstill, with legislation impossible. The only legal solution is for someone to finally win a majority. In 1855, that took 2 months and 133 rounds of voting. The Republican red wave of 2022 only produced such a narrow midterm victory that even a small group of their lawmakers can exert a huge amount of influence. The hardline stance of the dissenting Republicans is actually what many Democrat supporters expected out of the so-called squad of alleged progressives after their party's even narrower blue wave win in 2020.
Very much kind of putting to shame the squad and showing that being a unified bloc, even if you're a minority, if you take a fighting stance and you don't go along to get along, you can fight for meaningful wins. Unfortunately, now we have an example from the right.
The caucus of dissenters is often described as far right, while others note that their nominee for speaker is an African American and that their demands include more transparency in legislation and less power for congressional leaders. Many expected that a divided Congress would produce squabbles and political stagnation, but perhaps not this quickly. The electoral dysfunction at the federal level continues to embarrass and perhaps discredit democracy with American characteristics. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Politicians, activists, scholars, and researchers have gathered in Tehran to participate in the first international conference on Martyr Soleimani's school of thought. A role model in various social, political, military, and moral issues, who, according to the keynote speaker of the conference, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, Iran's parliament speaker, made great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region.
Throughout his life, Martyr Soleimani managed to deliver power and bring dignity to the Muslims worldwide. He has strived for the unity of the Muslim world and believed that power comes from the people. He was a true follower of the great founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini's school of thought.
For Russians, the name of Martyr Soleimani is a symbol of resistance. He was an exemplary figure. His revolutionary acts and deep belief in God opened a path, which today we refer to as Martyr Soleimani's school of thought.
3 years after the martyrdom of the top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, his legacy transcends generations, particularly in the West Asia region, where young justice seekers look up to him as a great role model.
Such conferences are very important because they help us understand the values that Mahdi Soleimani stood up for. I believe that his way of thinking and his philosophy is now spreading in the region, manifested especially in the way we deal with our enemies.
The enemy should know that their weapon is always war and killing innocent people. As you can see what Israel is doing to Palestine. I want to tell them our weapon is always with our faith and with belief.
Mahdi Soleimani was a brave man who can serve as a role model for all of us, not just in terms of the way he affected the region, but also as a person who had specific personality traits that made him a great human being.
According to the participants of this conference, Mahdi Soleimani shone as a military commander and at the same time as an experienced diplomat who had a deep understanding of the political aspects of the region and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani introduced a new way of thinking, and his philosophy and school of thought significantly transformed the geopolitical landscape of the region in a way that even his assassination by the United States led only to greater strength and prestige for what is referred to as the axis of resistance. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansarullah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawrib, Sana'a.
The start of the new year has brought bad news for the Italians. The average price of unleaded petrol at the pump in Italy has once again surged, increasing by over 15 cents. That is about 15% more compared to December 31st. The latest hike is due to the expiration of measures introduced in May to mitigate the nefarious effects on Italy's economy of an exceptionally high increase in the cost of energy that followed the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The price of unleaded petrol stands now at about 1.8 euros per litre, while that of diesel has reached almost 2 euros.
The increase in fuel costs at the turn of the new year is mainly due to the reinstatement of the full rates of excise duty and VAT on petrol, diesel and LPG that the former government led by Mario Draghi introduced last year. The spike is also due to the higher cost of mixing biofuels with petrol and diesel as required by the law.
Experts fear fuel prices might even increase further after February the 5th, when a European Union ban on Russian oil product imports kicks in as part of sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This follows a ban on Russian crude that took effect in December.
With a population of 59 million and about 40 million circulating vehicles, it is easy to understand how vital is the role of road transport in Italy. It accounts for three-quarters of all land transportation of goods. It goes without saying that the country's rising fuel costs for both petrol and diesel will have dreadful consequences for medium and small businesses and for everyday people.
While wages remain the same, fuel in general, energy costs keep rising. I'm very worried. Too much uncertainty.
What worries me the most is the fact that wages remain unchanged while the cost of living is skyrocketing. I have four kids and we are struggling to make ends meet.
Higher fuel prices further swell living costs for people in Italy as electricity and gas bills have increased by about 300% since September. Italy was expecting to raise almost 10 billion euros from measures targeting the super profits made by energy companies that benefited from the surge in oil and gas prices. So far, only one quarter of that amount has been paid to the tax office. Max Civili, Rome.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indict on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next, all bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which I never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the prime ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos, which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
UN has commemorated the third martyrdom anniversary of General Qasem Soleimani. People from different walks of life descended on the Imam Khomeini Mosalla in central Tehran to pay tribute to General Qasem Soleimani. The slain commander was a man who was widely revered as a national hero for all his efforts in the fight against terrorism and global arrogance. Addressing a ceremony, Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, said the message of attending the commemoration of Qasem Soleimani to all free men and women is that they should stand up and resist arrogance and block the way of oppressors and arrogant people.
Without a doubt, the reward of a national hero and a hero of the Islamic community is to protect all divine values. Commemorating General Qasem Soleimani is a global face of fighting arrogance and tyranny, glorifying all good things, and declaring hatred and aversion to oppression, arrogance, and domination.
The United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, along with deputy commander of Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. General Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq back in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from the terror group.
I have come here to honor General Qasem Soleimani. Although the enemy assassinated him, we are here to show the world that every one of us is Qasem Soleimani. His legacy of resistance will remain for good, and we will continue his path.
General Qasem Soleimani was an international personality and made great achievements in the region. Therefore, not only the Iranian people, but also the people of Iraq, Lebanon, and other countries in the region honor him. He was truly a role model for those who want to fight terrorism and resist arrogant powers.
Iranians believe although the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani put an end to his life, his legacy will continue forever, and he will remain as a role model for all resistance and anti-terror movements.
General Qasem Soleimani's personality was outstanding, not only in terms of decimating Daesh in Iraq and Syria, but also in sending out positive vibes and courage to everyone. It was actually a symbol of international resistance who redefined the rules of leadership. Salman Kujrib, Tehran.
The limelight.
Most Britons now think that Brexit was wrong. According to a new poll published by the British publication The Independent, more than two-thirds of Britons want a vote on rejoining the EU. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, most UK citizens believe their country is facing worse than it was as an EU member, as Savanta survey shows. More than two-thirds of Britons want a vote on rejoining the EU, according to a new poll published by The Independent recently. More than half of respondents described the decision to leave the bloc as wrong. The UK officially quit the EU on January 31st, 2020. 2020, following the 2016 Brexit referendum, with the Leave vote winning by a slim margin. The survey conducted for the newspaper by the research company Savanta showed 65% of respondents want a new vote, 10% more than last year. The public, however, are divided over when such a referendum should take place, with 22% saying it should be held now and 24% believing it should happen within the next 5 years. Less popular opinions are within next, that is 6 to 10 years, 11%, and in more than 20 years, 4%. Meanwhile, the number of those opposing a second vote on EU membership has declined from 32% to 42%. The survey also suggests that Brits hold a more negative view on the consequences of Brexit, with 54% of respondents saying leaving the EU was a bad decision, up from 46% last year. That view stems from the widely held belief that the UK's economy and global clout have been damaged by landmark decision to exit the EU. A 56% majority of respondents say leaving the bloc has made the economy worse, up from 44% last year. Half also think the UK's influence on the international stage has diminished, compared to just 39% last year. In addition, respondents take a dim view of the changes that Brexit has brought on the country's ability to control its own borders, with 50% saying it has worsened. The poll comes after a December study by the Centre for European Reform, CER, which estimated the UK's losses due to Brexit at £33 billion. Brexit had added 6% to UK food prices and has cost British workers about 2.6% of their wages in real terms, Swati Dhingra, an external member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, explained in November. The departure from the EU, according to Dhingra, has also caused a reduction in business investment and overall trade. In November 2022, also, Sky News reported that a survey from YouGov reveals that only 32% of Britons believe it was right to leave and 56% think it was wrong. The gap is the largest yet and marks a big swing in opinion, particularly since June 2021. In contrast, polling before the 2017 general election had suggested that more people believed Brexit was the right decision than not. One in five people who voted for Brexit now believe it was the wrong decision. Over the last 18 months, the percentage of Brexiteers who believe voting to leave the EU in 2016 was the right decision has dropped from 88% to a record low of 70%. Meanwhile, the number of Brexiteers who believe Brexit was the wrong thing to do has soared from 4% to 19%. Remain voters are more likely to have stood by their decision, with 9 in 10 still believing Brexit was wrong. In December 2022, The Times wrote, only one in three voters who backed leaving the European Union 6 years ago believe Brexit has been a success, polling for The Times suggests. The YouGov survey on the second anniversary of the Brexit trade deal found that 41% of Leave voters said Brexit had been worse for Britain than they imagined in 2016. Nearly a quarter, about 23%, said it had had a negative effect on Britain's place in the world, 34% said it was bad for the economy, and 41% said it had had a negative impact on immigration. The poll also found more Leave voters than not now supported a closer relationship with Europe, including the possibility of rejoining the single market.